Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
And to talk about Browns rookie minicamp and everything during the offseason and what's to come in 2025. We go to the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. We welcome in Browns General Manager Andrew Berry. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Lima, I'm excited for rookie minicamp, too, and I love Harold Fannin, too, so we got something in common.
Young kids, too, right? So, come on.
How are you guys doing this morning?
We're doing wonderful. We hope you're very, very well, Andrew. Tone, you go ahead and lead it off.
I did want to say, Andrew, next time you hear some random sports talk show host as you're driving around speculating on a QB going number two overall who ends up going in the fifth round, can maybe you tip us off next time, make us feel a little smarter? We're trying to educate our fans, Andrew, and they don't feel very educated now.
You know what? The draft always comes with surprises and some unexpected twists and turns. But we're excited to have the group that we have coming to Berea today.
Andrew Berry joining us here on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. So, how difficult was that to keep that under wraps? Because we find out later on, it's like, hey man, like 2 weeks they were working on that trade. And I'm like, hey, I can just about promise that Andrew would keep it close to the vest and not tell anybody. But I don't know if you can trust anybody in Jacksonville not to tell anybody. I mean, goodness gracious, the owner is a wrestling promoter for crying out loud. So was that a little bit, I mean, how long were those 2 weeks, allegedly, how long was those 2 weeks for you personally before the trade was actually consummated?
Yeah, I think there's, so maybe I should just start by saying, like, you know, it's kind of the first time I've really dealt with James Gladstone, and he was fantastic to deal with on the trade. You know, James and I, we really didn't know each other well, but we met at the combine and then obviously worked on the deal together. I'd say this, that, you know, anytime maybe you're doing business with someone for the first time, there's always maybe a little bit in the back of your mind of like, okay, are we solid on this? Is this going to, you know, is this going to stay quiet as appropriate? And you don't really know. But at the same time, I think, you know, they had every incentive to keep it tight as well, because they were making a major move up the board. And, you know, what I've learned is like they're really good people over there. And, you know, I was happy we were able to bring it to fruition.
And what's interesting is there's some audio that just surfaced in video from the Giants with their GM, Joe Shane, basically saying he knew about all this. He didn't know necessarily which team that you were talking to, but he said he knew the Browns weren't going to take Travis Hunter at number two overall. And what I always find interesting, like in the NBA, you know, a counterpart would be like Nico Harrison, right? Mavs GM, who did not really hold an auction for Luka. You're sitting there with the number two pick, but there's only so many teams that might have the assets that you might be truly looking for. So can you really even have an auction to let everybody know this pick is for sale?
No, it's a really good point. Like, you know, one of the reasons we really use the month of April, and really probably late March and April, to kind of canvas the league. Like, you know it's unrealistic. Like you're not gonna get some, or it's unlikely for you to get a deal for some team like moving 30-2, that type of thing. But you know, generally speaking, you'll make calls, you know, within the top half of the round. Whether there's interest in moving up, or if you do make a small move, would you make another move back? You know, as well as teams that you know maybe are picking around your slot at 33. So like you do get a fair amount of intel. Like you won't necessarily like auction off the pick. It's not like you go and say, hey, look, we're absolutely not picking a player here. We just, you know, we want to sell the pick to the highest bidder. But you do get a sense of like, hey, is there a willingness for teams to move up and show that you have flexibility in terms of how you'll use the asset.
All right. Do you, and maybe you could share with me some honesty, as honest as you can be, because I know how I would be if I was a GM, which is probably why I could not be one. Some part of you have to root against Travis Hunter the rest of his career.
No, Travis is like, he's an awesome player. He's an even better human being. Like, I think he's going to have a nice long career and do well in Jacksonville. You know, but the reality is like, you know, our charge is team building, and you know, there's more than one good player in the draft. You know, that's the other piece of it. And for us to be able to move down three spots, you know, get another top 35 pick and then a future one, in addition to selecting, you know, one of the best players in the draft. You know, we felt really good about it. That mix of who we end up selecting or how we use those resources will be better for our team in the long run.
Andrew Berry joining us on the show. I know it's not the same in your world, but in our world, I mean, you have a situation where the number 144th pick is more popular than the number 5 overall pick. How do you guys go about balancing everything during rookie minicamp and then going into training camp where you have Shedeur Sanders, who fell to the 5th round and certainly has a tremendous fan base behind him?
Yeah, I think that's like less of an issue for us internally. I know it leads to a lot of conversation and interest, you know, in the media and externally, and understandably so. But for us, we always talk about tuning out the external noise, because that doesn't really matter in terms of how we work, how we prepare. And in terms of Shedeur, like, you know, his big thing is making the team and earning a role. You know, that's all rookies have to focus on doing that. It's making the team first and then earning a role. And, you know, listening to the outside noise does nothing to help accomplish those.
What does the organization want to challenge him specifically with?
Yeah, I'd say it's less about challenging him specifically and more about our rookies in general. Like, they've all got to come up the learning curve quickly. You know, they're learning a new system. They're in a new environment. You know, they're learning new skills, you know, kind of on the job. And, you know, Kevin's message to them last night during the first team meeting was, hey, your focus is, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but it's to make the team. Nobody here has made the team yet, so it's making the team. And then after that, it's earning a role. And that's the same thing for Shedeur.
Andrew Berry joining us on the show. You got four active guys in that quarterback room. Does it make the rookie camp that much more important for he and Dylan Gabriel to take advantage of all the reps that they get?
You know, I think that because we have two quarterbacks, two rookie quarterbacks, we are structuring it a little bit differently. You know, because we do want them to get a greater volume of reps than we typically do in a rookie mini camp. But I think it's probably less about rookie mini camp and more about taking advantage of opportunities really over the next, you know, call it 4 months. And Kevin and Tommy and the offensive staff, they have a really good plan around that. I mean, and that's probably even before we were in the world where we had drafted the two quarterbacks. We had all, you know, we've typically taken four quarterbacks into camp. Now the rep distribution had always been maybe a little bit different because, you know, we had a clear or at least entrenched starter. And so this year obviously is a little bit different, but, I think they've done a really nice job of designing the offseason programming and, you know, I think the plans that we have for training camp in the preseason, there will be plenty of reps to evaluate all four of those passers.
Andrew Berry with us right now on the hotline, GM of the Cleveland Browns. Every year now, there seems to be a fair share of like controversial players in a draft for whatever reason. But what's interesting about Shedeur is everybody kept talking about what a great kid he truly was and how his ability to process was something that was fantastic. But yet, as we get closer to the draft and after the combine, it seemed like there was some character assassination stuff that comes out. Do the GMs need to get together. I don't know if it's the owners' meetings or what. Need to get together and say, can we stop leaking things that are negative about these guys? I know there's certainly gamesmanship that goes on, but it just seems unfortunate, the stuff that's been said about Shador and some of his meetings with specific teams.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I would be surprised if most of that comes from general managers in the league. I think, you know, there are so many touch points throughout the process, whether it's agents, media, you know, front office staff, you know, assistant coaches, you name it. So it could really, I mean, things like that can come from anywhere. But I don't think that's, it's certainly not unique to Shador. It's not unique to even rookie players. Like, we see that all the time with, you know, with vets, and honestly, even like non-player employees. Like, you hear it with coaches, you hear it with executives. So, like, I think that's just kind of part of our business. And as Peter always says, it's a little bit like life in the big city. Now, that being said, like, I personally hate the character assassinations with, you know, a lot of these kids coming out, where we just kind of, like, you know, publicly just pick them apart, because you're right. Like, oftentimes it's smoke, or it's someone acting in self-interest, and, you know, it's not really fair to the kids. But, you know, at the same time, it's unfortunately probably something that every athlete is going to have to deal with at some point in their career.
We've had plenty of adversity over the years, but you seem to be pretty unbothered when there are any of these steep challenges. But does it surprise you or annoy you at all that there seems to be an undercurrent in NFL media and fans that actually thinks it was the owner and not you that made the Shador pick? Is it insulting?
No, I don't really pay any attention to any of that. I mean, we're super excited to have him. You know, we spent a lot of time with him in the process. He's a good kid. He's talented. You know, we were surprised that he was available at 144. And we're excited to add him to the room, but he's got to compete and earn a role just like Dylan, just like Kenny, just like Joe. And so we're excited to see that competition, because we do have a number of players in that room that we have a level of belief in. So that's really my focus. I don't really care about the narrative stuff, to be honest with you.
Andrew Berry with us on the show. What is Joe Flacco's role now with two rookies on this roster?
To take advantage of the reps that he gets and compete for the job. Like, it doesn't really change. Like, look, we will have we have a number of professional individuals in that room, and they'll get along well, they'll work together, you know, but Joe's job also isn't to bring along rookies. We have a very experienced and good coaching staff. That's their job. Joe's job is to compete and earn a role just like the others in the room.
Do you think Joe Flacco even really needs reps, though? If it is a competition, but, you know, he picked up the offense pretty quick and seamlessly the last time around. That led to a playoff run.
Yeah, Joe's played. It's a fair question. Joe's played a lot of football. I think every quarterback would tell you they like the reps, but I think it's probably a fair observation that you know, Joe probably needs a little bit. Well, honestly, just Joe needs a lot less time on task, maybe relative to the younger players in that room, because he is so experienced and so seasoned. You know, he's seen a lot of football, played a lot of football.
Andrew Berry with us on the show. So you're the current general manager, so I have to ask you this question, even though this has been going on since you and I were in high school. I have seen this football team try to balance winning with evaluating a young quarterback based on the need for possibly a future quarterback many times, and it has failed many times. What makes you guys different? How do you plan on going about the balance of winning football games, making things better for the future, but also evaluating two young guys who one or possibly both could end up on your active roster week one?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't know what was done in the past, and honestly, I really don't care. We're really focused on the present, and I think, you know, honestly, like, I understand the question. I understand that everybody wants to, like, fast forward 4 or 5 months just because it's interesting. But, you know, our focus is really on development this spring, and, like, figuring out, like, hey, who's going to be on the team and what roles they're gonna play. And then we'll go from there.
When there is a free agent available coming off surgery and you have some interest, is it protocol for you to work them out?
Not necessarily. It depends on the injury. It also, you know, usually teams are pretty good about sharing, with the player's consent, sharing medical information. So it depends on the injury. It depends on where they are in their recovery. So, it's I guess maybe a little bit case dependent. That's the best way to answer it.
Well, I was then going to ask the follow up. Did you work out Nick Chubb?
Oh, I got you. No, we.
Sorry about that.
No worry. So, Nick. With his foot injury, he's recovered from that. It's not like last year where, he had a borderline catastrophic knee injury, and he was still recovering and working his way back. Like, in the grand scheme of major injury, like, I guess there's no such thing as truly a minor injury or a minor, break. But his foot is fine.
Have you talked to Nick Chubb recently?
Certainly kept in contact with him and his reps, leading into the draft. So depending on what you say recently, yes, but we haven't really necessarily been in strong communication after the draft.
So you can't rule anything out with him coming back?
I wouldn't rule anything out, but I would say that it's probably increasingly unlikely. Like, we do have, two young guys that we liked. We think Jerome plays a role, and it's just it's basically kind of maybe seeing how the roles shake out and, in the running back room. Look, you're never going to rule out someone, as near and dear to our heart as Nick. And I would expect him to take another step, being a year removed from the knee injury. But I'd say it's maybe a return is less likely, at least in the short term, with us right now.
So just on a human level, and you understand, you talk to fans probably anytime you go out or go to the grocery store or interact with anybody from Northeast Ohio, he is one of the treasured assets, treasured athletes in the history of this city. So how do you balance the business of doing what you have to do for the betterment of the football team and then that emotional part of it, not to mention, you got guys in sales that probably would love to have Nick Chubb on the football team?
I guess the way I would say is, like, my job in decision making is to be non-emotional, and then in terms of managing and treating people, it's to be able to do it as empathetically as possible. I think one of the hardest things is when you transition away from a player that meant a lot to the organization and meant a lot to the community. But the reality is, like, look, I'd love for key players in our organization to stay with us forever, play to their 45. Unfortunately, the sport doesn't allow that. That's part of, the tough parts of the job, but it doesn't change how you view or treat or, love the guys that have come through as people.
There's kind of a inner working. I want to find out how draft night really works. And you talked about the Jacksonville trade, how long you worked on it, but what about the calls that just come in out of the blue on draft night? Is there a different kind of pressure for you to have to process that type of information, what kind of a deal they may be pitching? And then who are you running that by immediately? How many people even need to hear about that? And are there deals that just right off the bat you're saying, absolutely not even within the realm of possibility?
It's funny. I actually got asked this question yesterday by our personnel operations director, Megan Rock. So I'll be honest, like a big part of April is the scenario planning and the trade planning, so that when you get to draft night, it's really more about just executing. I view the draft room, it's almost like your cockpit, so to speak, or, maybe like the sideline operation with Kevin, where everybody who's in there has a role. Some of the roles, they may field some trade calls. And then we have two people, Ken Kovash and Andrew Healy, who handle a lot of the trade pricing. So we actually have a screen in the draft room that shows the value of potential deals. So they're the primary people I lean on in that regard. There are definitely deals that come through that it's like, okay, like that's like a non-starter, whether it's the value of the deal or who's on the board. And there are others that we think through a little bit more, a little bit more intently. But it's something that we've obviously made a lot of trades here, and we've made a lot of trades, during the draft. So it's a pretty well-oiled machine, and we have a good group of people, a good group of minds with them.
Myles Garrett signed an extension with you guys. We know there was an up and down off season, a little touch and go with him. What's expected of him? Is there a challenge of more leadership with him as he goes on in his career, especially since you guys have so many more younger players than you've had in the past?
Yeah, I'd say that you don't need to have a C on your chest or necessarily be a veteran to be a leader. What's expected of Miles is to be a professional and to produce at a high level. Because of his standing in the league, he can have really strong influence, and you know, that is something that you know, we will challenge Miles to do every year. You know, but that burden doesn't just solely fall on his shoulders. His primary responsibility is to be a pro and produce at a high level.
Last one for me, Andrew. Ravens GM Eric DaCosta made some waves about a month ago, referencing that he actually uses mock drafts. They use it as a data point. And I'm just curious, you're trying to anticipate who could be available when it's the Browns' turn to pick. So how do you incorporate that? Is there a wisdom of crowds element of this that you can use to really aggregate all that's out there to try to anticipate who's going to be available?
Yeah, no, there is some of that, but it's probably not just, you know, we'll use the, you know, the betting markets in Vegas. We'll use the, you know, mock drafts, usually with publishers who, you know, may be getting their intel from, you know, from team sources, because, you know, not all mock drafts are created equal. And you may get, like, you know, a general sense of the market. Now, there comes a point in the draft where boards diverge pretty heavily, and that's usually probably early to mid third round. So you do have to take it with a grain of salt. But if you can aggregate some of the information, there can be a little bit of signal, you know, in terms of how the market is viewing a player. It's not, you know, it's not something that you just kind of buy hook, line, and sinker, but it is something that can be helpful when used appropriately.
Andrew, thank you for the time. We'll talk to you again here as training camp starts up in a bit. Enjoy rookie camp.
All right, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Andrew Berry, the Browns general manager, joining us on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline. So the Nick Chubb, obviously not so great news about that.
It's over. Yeah.
He said increasingly unlikely. He said increasingly unlikely. I want to say it's over.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America, for America.
On my podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, we share the keys to succeed in business and in life. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Baskin and Phelps, 92.3 The Fan. We are waiting for Danny Green. He's our Odyssey Sports NBA insider. We'll have him on the line here shortly. He's been great. He's been catching up with us every week to get us up to speed on what's going on in the NBA playoffs, especially his old team, the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Chris sent me an email earlier in the show about the stadium things that we were talking about.
Yeah,
he just followed it up. Orange smoke, Brook Park.
Ah.
Brown smoke, downtown.
Aha.
Playing off our
previous
conversation.
We're waiting for a new Pope, by the way. We should have one here momentarily. Cameras from all over the world are focused in on Vatican City, and it's while we're talking sports. We'll give you a heads up on anything that's going on there, too. So, just interesting. We were talking about the white smoke went up, about an hour ago? A little bit more than an hour ago, I think. So, I was paying along.
I lost the...
3 hours ago?
The white smoke clock.
Oh. All right, so...
Didn't see it.
Yeah, I don't know. We were just kind of watching along, see if that... Gotcha. So, all right, so here's what we're going to do. If that happens, we'll tell you by the end of the segment. On the line, though, right now is Odyssey Sports NBA insider Danny Green. Insider calls are brought to you by Hyundai. Now you can buy a new Hyundai at Amazon. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hey, Danny, how are you?
Good. How you guys doing?
We are doing good, except for the fact the Cavs are down 0-2. It's not been a lot of fun the last couple of days. The injuries are totally piled up on the Cavs over this, you know, over the series through two games. And Kenny Atkinson wasn't happy, kind of voiced his opinion after game one with guys getting taken out. And then they end up losing at the buzzer in game two. That was no fun or close to the buzzer. And now we head into game three with less than an 8% chance of trying to come back to win the series. I don't even want to talk about the series. I just want to talk about game three. Just your assessment of the series just so far.
It's been unfortunate, man, especially to see the injuries happen and the fact that you guys had chances to win in both games. You know, the fatigue, the turnovers, the non-box outs, just some of the immature play cost you, but, you know, ultimately comes down to the lack of having the bodies that you normally have in. So, but I said you guys have shown that you can win and win without those guys. So I'm expecting you guys to get one of those games in Indiana.
Danny, how do NBA players deal with injuries? It's been my contention that if these guys thought they could actually play and contribute, there's no way they're not out on the floor. What's your history tell you?
How do players deal with it? You mean
yeah,
in terms
and,
of,
and if they could go, if they thought they could help, they'd be out there, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I would like to think so, man. I mean, I said I know those guys personally, so I think they would go. But today's NBA, you just never know. You know, old school guys, they play through a lot of things. And I'm not speaking I'm speaking in general here.
Right, right.
So there's other situations where guys may sit out when I don't know if they know what's marginal, what's not. But this is the playoffs, and I think any competitive kid that's watched the game growing up and loves being a part of the league wants to play. And I said, I know these guys personally. I know Darius. I know Evan. I don't know DeAndre, but I know that they would go if they could. So there's got to be severe type injury, especially with Darius taking more games than people expected him to take with the toe. You know, they thought it was going to be like two games and he'd be back. But it's been three games now. We saw DeAndre Hunter fall. We saw Evan, you know, tweak his ankle. So those things look like serious injuries, but you'd hope that it's something that can heal and they can get back within a few days.
That said, and I agree with you, NBA players who are handsomely paid aren't necessarily getting paid to play Charlotte in February. You know, this is the time of the year where you're supposed to go. And it's just such a tough situation for them to be in, a tough situation for Kenny Atkinson. How did he handle game two? If there was something he should have done differently, in your opinion, what was it?
I think he did great, man. I think he did everything possible to give that team a chance to win. You know, I guess it could have been the only thing different, maybe because Dom was so exhausted at the end, you got to find a way to give him a break. I don't know how many timeouts he had left, but could have used him a little bit more down the stretch just to give him a breather. Or I mean, it was too late to sub him, but he was trying to bring the ball. He didn't have energy to bring the ball up. And I said, I knew it was happening for them. The turnovers, the offensive rebounds, the free throws, the free throw box outs, those are small details. That's not coaching. You know, it's the players. But yes, the only thing he could have done is just try to find Don a breather or, you know, get a timeout or two later on down the stretch. That I think he used them. I don't know how many he had left or if he used all of them. But Don was gassed, and that fatigue cost him.
Danny, the two-minute report came out. It said at the end of the game, blatantly missed lane violations. The NBA admitted the two-minute report identified two plays in the final minute that should have been nullified and replaced with jump balls at midcourt. I just really want to punch my screen when I read the two-minute report at the end because it's like, okay,
yeah,
I understand.
The two-minute report sucks, especially we've seen the whole Detroit situation with Tim Hardaway and
yep.
How egregious that was. But yes, there was lane violations, I thought for sure. I also thought they didn't start the clock on time when one turnover happened. When Strus, I think, threw the ball away to Nembhard, the clock took a couple seconds for it to start. Or maybe my TV or my phone was slow behind, but I feel like there was some clock issues, there was some violation issues, there was some random things. But that's part of the playoffs. I've been a part of some crazy things, even in San Antonio, where, you know, Manu was hit with the ball and the guy was taking the ball out. I think it was Deion Waiters, you know, hit him with the ball. They didn't call the foul. We tried the foul. They called the second one. The guy got an N1. So the two-minute release is always a pain in the ass to see. But yes, they got to be better with those calls, and they can review it and go back. But even still, you can't put yourself in that situation, in that position, and you can do things better, like boxing out. You know there's a free throw coming. The guy that's got a free throw box out dunk. You can't let Tyrese Haliburton, who's shooting the free throw, get his own rebound and get back out. You guys just couldn't get a rebound at the right time, and that was lack of size. You didn't have Evan. You didn't have DeAndre. That's two guys that could play the four for you, if not the five. You know, Evan can play the five. So the lack of size costs you, and the lack of discipline of not boxing out costs you guys a lot.
Danny, is it real that I mean, we see it. It looks like the game is more physical in the playoffs than it is during the regular season. Although Jeff and I will say that, you know, maybe, you know, it was more physical probably when you first came into the league. I thought it was way more physical than it is now. Just touch on how physical you think the playoffs have been this year. And would you rather have it that way, or would you rather have the refs blowing the whistle on everything?
No, I'd rather have it that way all season long. It's been great. Yeah. You know, it's close to where it's a, this is what basketball is about, real basketball. We don't want to see the foul baiting and free throws and the flopping. No, we want to see real basketball. And I love that they do it in the playoffs, but I'd rather see it during the regular season too, because some of the numbers get gaudy, the game gets slowed down. It gets kind of ugly and messy. But, yes, this physicality has been amazing. It's been awesome. You know, you see Houston and Golden State go at it. You see Detroit and Knicks go at it. You know, you guys going at it, even with Orlando, like, you know, and Boston. Like, you see the physicality and guys actually competing and going after each other. Now you see Knicks, Celtics. So this series has been great, too. Even the more, like, all the series have been physical and been great, and you've seen guys kind of, you know, beating up on each other a little bit with keeping it clean in the same sense. So this is the type of basketball we love to see, and it is very similar to when I said when I was playing, when I first came in, and so I just wish they kept it consistent throughout the year.
Danny Green joining us, and of course, Danny is our Odyssey Sports Insider, and Insider calls are brought to us by Hyundai. Now you can buy a new Hyundai from the comfort of your home with Amazon. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. I know I'm speaking to an audience here that loves the three-point shot. Why? Because it made you a lot of money. Cavs are 20 of 77 so far against Indiana, just over 25% on threes. Celtics are exactly at 25% on threes. They've made 25 of 100 threes in the first two games, Danny. If it's not falling, and you were a really good three-point shooter, if it's not falling for a team in a playoff situation, do you keep shooting it? Do you work on something else? What do you do?
I mean, there's just no excuse for Boston because they have so many threats that can do other things. It'd be one thing if you were just a team that only shot threes, you know, and that you didn't have guys capable of actually getting to the basket and finishing. But you have guys that can get to the free throw line. You have guys that can get to the basket. And, you know, they're a team that lives and dies by it, and they've been dying lately. And it's kind of biting them, you know, in the foot. So, you know, and they were one of the teams that mathematically tried to, I wouldn't say cheat the system, but if they said, you know, we take 63s and you don't take at least 40 or 50, you can't keep up. Like, mathematically, you're not going to win the game. And right now, I guess that mathematical theory is kind of hurting them. But, yeah, you got to find ways to get to the basket, get to the free throw line. Obviously, your guys that are shooters, you're supposed to shoot them. Especially if they're open, you don't stop shooting the basketball. You want to take the open looks, but you have other guys on the team that can do other things for that reason. And you have superstars like Jaylen and Jason that can get to the free throw line or get you a basket, or shoot a mid-range. And sometimes you just don't lay an egg, but when you have the talent to do so, to do other things, you can't be that stubborn. You got to figure out a way to get you a basket or break the seal somehow and attack differently.
Danny, the Knicks beat the Celtics. It's like, it's really, really hard for the home team to win, right? That's what it feels like right now. So, whether the OKC. Like,
yeah,
why?
OKC, they got that one yesterday. This is start of the season. You said it's crazy to say immaturity for a championship team, but Boston is one of the most immature teams that I've seen that has won a championship. They just make things harder for themselves than it has to be. And they kind of play down to their opponent. They play down to their talent level because they're the most talented team in the league. They're the best team in the league when healthy and playing the way we know they can play. But they're also going to give you a game or two because they're just going to shoot themselves out of it. Usually it doesn't happen back-to-back and back-to-back games at home, but they did that at home, back-to-back games against the New York Knicks, which is a team that they're talented enough to sweep. They swept in the regular season, They're talented enough to beat in a gentleman's sweep. You know, they also had troubles with Orlando. You know, they had troubles with the teams that said they shouldn't have troubles with. It's because they lack some maturity at times, and you know, they kind of play down to their opponent at times. So, yeah, I don't know what else. It's got to be a mental thing, but I'm sure they'll figure it out. That's the team that I still don't count out. If you're down 0-2 from home, you know, Cleveland, same. If you guys get healthy, I think you guys can turn it around. It's going to be very tough for you guys to win the series. Boston's a team that can win four straight for sure and get there. But the way that they're playing, just not smart. It looks like it's going to be tough for them to get out of the series as well.
So pick the winner of the Eastern Conference Series and then tell me who's going to the finals out of the East.
So for me, I'm gonna still stick with Boston. I had Boston to start. I'm gonna stick with that coming out of the East. But right now, they're making me look really bad.
Welcome to our life. Can the Cavs bounce back? You think they'll do it, Danny? I think obviously with the injuries, they're hard pressed to do it.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility, man. But to be honest with you, I think the chances are very slim. And it's all dependent on if any of those guys come back healthy. It's a lot of dependent on injuries and health. So, and I can't rely on that. Even if they do come back, they're not going to be 100%. You're going to Indiana in their home building. I don't see you getting two of them. You need both of those games to get back in the series. I can see you getting one of them. I just don't see you getting both.
Danny, as always, you know, we love talking to you, and thanks for breaking it down. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Danny.
We head out to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline and welcome on Cavs and NBA reporter for Cleveland.com, the great Chris Fedor, on with us now. What's up, buddy?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Doing pretty well here. Thank you for joining. Are you in Indy yet?
No, I'm driving up tomorrow morning with Joe Varden from The Athletic.
But you didn't have to add The Athletic. We know Joe.
Well, not everybody does. I know you guys do, but not everybody does. Or maybe
Cleveland.
Everybody does. Maybe I'm underselling his reach. I don't know.
No, we knew yesterday. We took, or 2 days ago, we took a call, and this guy was he was just bashing the Cavs, and then Nick made a reference to Jason Lloyd. He's like, I don't know who Jason Lloyd is. We're like, oh, you're not a Cavs fan.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then he outed himself. He was obviously a Pacers fan calling in.
And we thought it was Jason Lloyd because he just sounded like Jason Lloyd, but talking like this.
Ah, I gotcha.
Chain smoker Jason White.
Yeah, if you want to confirm whether that was or not, I guess we'll start with the obvious. We just played Kenny Atkinson from earlier today talking about, you know, the Cavs need to show resiliency. How screwed do you think they are down 0-2?
Well, I think the answer to that question depends on the status of Darius Garland, DeAndre Hunter, and Evan Mobley. I felt like coming into this series that it was going to be a difficult matchup for the Cavs for a variety of reasons. I picked the Cavs to win in six, but I thought it was going to be a competitive series that probably could have gone either way. I almost put it in Cavs in seven just because I have that level of respect for the Pacers. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. They're deep. They're balanced in a lot of ways. They're like the Cavs. They like to play similar to the Cavs. And I thought there were some stylistic complications that the Cavs were going to have to deal with in this series. And we've seen that play out over the first two games. But now you're talking about potentially being without three of your four leading scorers in the postseason. Like, I don't think the Cavs can win a series that way. I have a lot of respect for Kenny Atkinson as a coach. I have a lot of respect for Donovan Mitchell and the Superman cape that he can certainly put on, that he tried to put on in game two. But this isn't Miami anymore. This is the Indiana Pacers that went to the conference finals last year. This is a team that has a lot of positive things going for them. I don't think the Cavs can win this series without Evan Mobley, Darius Garland, and DeAndre Hunter. Or if those guys are limited, if they're able to play and they're limited, I don't think that's enough either. They got to win four of the next five games, and three of those are on the road, and nobody knows the status of three of their most important players. Yeah, I don't think there's a good feeling about the Cavs' chances in this series today. Now, if we get an update tomorrow at Shoot Around saying, hey, Darius is out there, DeAndre's out there, Evan's out there, and there's more of a chance than what it felt like the other night of those guys playing, then, you know, I might have a different take on it.
Hi, Chris. Because you brought up Joe Vardon, I'll tell you what he told us a few days ago when he was here on this show. He'd said something to the effect of how the Cavs are just very cautious, and players respect this, by the way, the idea that they don't rush any of these guys back from injury, and they really don't push them to play if they're not 100% ready to play. Is that working as a detriment to the Cavs right now, if they are being extra cautious, or do you feel like that's just, at this point, doesn't matter, because if these guys could play, they would play?
Yeah, I mean, is anybody going to hammer Steph Curry for not playing for the Warriors for the next week? Like, he can't play. He's got a hamstring injury. He can't play. Evan Mobley couldn't walk the other day. Like, what are we doing? Like, he could not walk the other day. He could not put full weight on his foot. How is he supposed to play? How is he supposed to be effective against the fastest team in the NBA? How is he supposed to be effective against a team that spreads you out and makes you cover so much ground on the defensive end of the floor? So, like, all of this conjecture about all these injuries, look, the Cavs are doing something wrong, I believe. The fact that they're listing these guys as questionable is stupid, and they got to get away from that. Because there was no chance, none, of Evan Mobley playing the other night. I saw him in the locker room before the game, and he didn't have any kind of gear on whatsoever. He was about to go eat his dinner. There was no chance of him playing in the game the other night. Same thing when it came to Darius Garland and DeAndre Hunter. So, the listing of these guys as questionable, I understand, is playing into this whole conversation, and the Cavs have to be better about that. They think they're in the right by doing that. Obviously, gamesmanship, not showing your cards, making Indiana have to guess. When you list a guy as doubtful, it's very different than questionable. If you list a guy as out, it's obviously very different than questionable. So they think they're doing the right thing from a strategic standpoint, but it's not helping. It's not helping the optics of these guys. It's not helping the conversation surrounding these injuries. Darius Garland has pain and swelling in his toe. He might have to play with a carbon fiber insert if he does get to play. Like, every time he moves, every time he makes a sharp cut, it's painful for him. In that condition, against the Indiana Pacers, it's very, very difficult to play. And DeAndre Hunter, like, can't grab a basketball. His touch is different. Like, you have to worry about, like, all those things when you talk about these kinds of injuries. So, look, this is the playoffs. All these guys want to play. They have busted their ass throughout the course of this regular season to be in a position to help this team win a championship. You think they want to sit? You think they want to be stuck on the bench, relegated to cheerleaders? If they could play, they would play. They can't play. That's the problem.
Chris Fedor on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Jared Allen, and I'm going to paraphrase here, which I'm great at, suggested kind of at the end of game two that they felt like they had figured out a way to get after Indiana and to beat Indiana. Do you see what he sees, even though they lost in game two?
Yes, absolutely. I think there were things that they did not do in game one that they were in control of, where they just failed. They came up short. You know what I mean? Like, there are certain things that you simply can't control, but there are things that you can control in a basketball game. And in game one, they failed at a lot of those different things. And then game two, you saw the differences, the physicality that they played with defensively. They were pushing Indiana off of their spots. They were pushing Indiana's offense further away from the basket, making Indiana's offense start a little bit later in the shot clock, you know, making it more difficult for Tyrese Halliburton to get touches. Even a lot of the offense was running through Andrew Nembhard for the first three quarters of the game. That's a very different attack. That's a very different approach for an Indiana team. So the Cavs were partly responsible for that. I also think the Cavs found something, and this was a byproduct of Evan Mobley not being available. But I think it showed them in this particular series against this opponent in this matchup, playing two bigs is schematic suicide. Like, what are you doing? 18 minutes with Evan Mobley and Jared Allen on the floor together in game one, they were obliterated. They had an offensive rating of 100 and a defensive rating of 150. Oof. Those two guys against this team that spreads you out, that plays so fast, nah. That's not going to work. They have to cover too much ground. They have to play out on the perimeter. And the Cavs don't gain enough on the offensive end of the floor with those two guys. So I think that's something that they might have found, too, that the kind of style that they have to use offensively to be the kind of offense that they want to be and they have to be in this series against this opponent, that's something as well. So those two things really stand out to me as stuff that they can control moving forward into this series that were better in Game 2 than they were in Game 1.
Kenny Atkinson said his big regret from Game 2 was not going deeper into his bench. If he does go deeper into his bench, what does that look like to you?
I just get so confused by this whole conversation of the Cavs ran out of gas. And Kenny Atkinson brought it up the other night. And look, like, I know it's tough to play against Indy. It is the fastest team in the NBA. They put constant pressure on you. The way that they get the ball up quickly, the kind of stress that they put on your defense, the responsibilities that some of these other guys had in the absence of Darius, DeAndre, and Evan, like that increased too. But none of these guys played 40 minutes, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've got Mikal Bridges playing 51 and coming up with big plays down the stretch. You know what I mean? So, like, Kenny said that in the post game, and I just, like, popped my head up. I'm like, wait a minute. I think the highest minute total was 37. And I get it. It's tough. It's playoff intensity. It's playoff physicality. But, man, I don't know how you could run out of gas in that kind of situation when you don't even touch the 40-minute mark. So, I mean, I think that's something that they obviously have to look at is, okay, like, if we have a threshold of our guys – where we don't want them to touch the 40-minute mark. And if that's the case, that's the case, and that's fine. Like, Kenny knows his team certainly better than anybody else. So if he feels like, you know, pushing those guys a little bit too much to that kind of workload, then he's going to have to extend his bench, and he's going to have to try and steal minutes throughout the course of the game. You know, I thought Rick Carlisle did something brilliant in Game 2, and I think – the whole time as that game was going, even when they were down 20, even when they were trailing basically the entire game, he was playing the long game. I think he believed that Indiana was going to wear out the Cavs in the fourth quarter. Now, did he see it playing out exactly the way that it did and the outcome having the exact plan come together? No, but I think he felt like Indiana was going to wear out the Cavs and they were going to have an advantage in the fourth quarter. So, like, he rested Tyrese Halliburton, I think it was for 8 straight minutes from the first quarter into the second quarter. He played 3 minutes of Jairus Walker that were not effective at all, but that stole time for Pascal Siakam. And he went deeper into his bench just to try and steal minutes so that his team could be fresh and able to take advantage of a worn-down Cavs team in the fourth quarter. And that's something that I think Kenny has to consider. Whether those minutes are effective or not, they could be in the long run late in the game so that, you know, Donovan Mitchell is able to move or something like that in the final 2 minutes.
Chris, I promise you this isn't a loaded question, and that's usually okay. When I say that means it's a loaded question. Is Kenny Atkinson having a bad series, or has what he's tried to do just not worked out?
Yeah, I don't think it's been the greatest Kenny series, but I also think there are circumstances surrounding that, right? Like, you can't tell the story of the Cavs being in an 0-2 hole without mentioning the fact that they haven't had Darius Garland. The shot creation of him, the playmaking, the scoring, the ability to occupy one of Indiana's better defenders so that that guy doesn't completely stifle another player on the Cavs offense that's important to their success. And obviously in Game 2, he was missing 53 points from his team. Three of his most important players, DeAndre Hunter, going into Game 2, if he didn't have a dislocated thumb, was going to be a huge component of everything that the Cavs did at both ends of the floor, because they realized in Game 1 just how effective he was in terms of lineup versatility, in terms of the way that Indiana was guarding defensively and how they could potentially counter that. So the Cavs were preparing internally for DeAndre to be a big component of Game 2, and then he's unavailable. So that obviously worked against Kenny. The other thing that I think we have to consider here is that Rick Carlisle is one of the best coaches in the NBA. He is a tactical genius. He has done this before to great coaches, including Eric Spoelstra in the NBA Finals. He has been in a lot more playoff games than Kenny Atkinson, and his roster is full strength, whereas Kenny is limited at this point in time. So I do think there are things that he has that he would like to have back, decisions that he would like to have back. And there are tactical things that he hasn't done as well as certainly he did in the Miami series and during the regular season. But I also think that he's being put in a difficult position, given what's available to him and what's not. In saying all of that, you know, he's got to be better going into game three with some of these decisions.
Chris, what's your read on Ty Jerome's struggles?
Well, look, I mean, so did you guys watch Maverick, the Top Gun movie, the second one?
Yes, and the other 9 billion people on the planet did too, Chris.
Hey,
you
like
guys see this, you see this little
summer
movie? It was a series of movies, Harry Potter. You ever heard of that character, Harry Potter, Chris?
Got a new one for you, Star Wars.
Yeah, you're going to love it.
I got one for you, Titanic.
Not going to love the ending. Like,
might be headed that way. So there's this line in Maverick, in Top Gun Maverick, where they're talking about the mission, and somebody says the parameters of this mission call for something different, right? The parameters of this mission against Indiana call for something different than the regular season. They call for something different than against the Miami Heat. And that's it. Like, what the Cavs did in the regular season, it doesn't matter because it's against this particular opponent. What Ty Jerome did in the regular season or against Miami doesn't matter. It's against this particular opponent. The lack of athleticism is showing. The lack of quickness is showing. The lack of foot speed at both ends of the floor, that's showing. The peskiness of the on-ball defenders of Indiana, and they've got multiple. They don't just have one. Miami had one. It was Davion Mitchell. He couldn't guard everybody. Indiana has multiple of those kinds of defenders at the point of attack that are being really, really physical, really, really feisty. Andrew Nembhard, TJ McConnell, Aaron Nesmith. They're making it difficult on Ty. I also think, you know, he missed some shots in game two that he would normally make. But I do think that there is a problem with him from an athleticism standpoint, from a speed and quickness standpoint, that didn't show up as much over the course of 82. But against this opponent that can exploit those weaknesses and deficiencies that Ty has, I think it becomes a little bit more obvious as this series goes on. So he's going to have to find other ways. Like, what are his advantages? What are his strengths? He's crafty. He's bigger than some of these guys. So he's going to have to try and win those kinds of ways in this series. If he can, we'll see.
Could you have picked a nerdier quote from Maverick? The parameters
so funny,
of this
right?
mission? Not you told me not to think.
He sounded like Stefanski and Barry there for
not
a second.
Not It's the Only One I Got. Not It's Time to Let Go by Iceman. The parameters. You could have pulled that out of any movie. That could be from any war movie, the parameters of this mission. And that's the one you remembered?
I'll have you know, I quoted Maverick in Series 1 against Miami as well to a couple of the players in the locker room. And I actually wrote it, too. And it was much better line. I admit, it was a much better line. It was the one of, it's not the plane, it's the pilot, sir. Because everybody was talking about Eric Spoelstra and his X's and O's and all these different tactical things that he could do. And I turned to somebody and I said, it's not the plane, it's the pilot. And they don't have the pilots.
Mach 10? Let's give them Mach 10. The procedures of the parameters of the Paramus, New Jersey. Good Lord.
I know. There were much better lines, but I just didn't think they were appropriate to the question that you asked me and the response that I was willing to give to said question.
I'm not buying it.
I thought it was fitting. Could you at least say that the quote that I pulled was fitting?
It worked. I can't wait for you to drop it with Joe Varden in the car ride tomorrow.
We've got 4.5 hours, so it'll be a good time.
Chris, great stuff, buddy.
Thanks, Chris.
Other than that one quote, we appreciate you. Safe travels.
You got it, guys. See ya.
the parameters of the mission.
Nerd.
We'll react to what Chris had to say. Other than that, in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Eric on Twitter says, I swear to you here, if Darius doesn't play in the next game, I want him out next year.
Oh, my God. Here we go.
That's where we're at right now.
Well, to talk about that and so much more, someone who's going to be on the call coming up tomorrow, ESPN 7:30. Ryan Rucco joins us right now on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Ryan, we've gotten a deluge of calls over the last few days saying not only is this team soft, but Darius Garland is soft. Your thoughts, Ryan?
I mean, I think it's hard to call a player soft when you don't know all the details of what they're dealing with, their limitations, what they're feeling, right? And I think, are there times where that's true and somebody has an injury that one player would play through and another wouldn't? Yeah, of course that's true. But I think it's a precarious road to walk on when you don't know that, because – you know, there have been accusations like that in the past where a player is much more hurt than you realize or than, you know, is originally diagnosed. So I always like to steer clear of that unless, you know, you have people inside the organization who are questioning that. And then even that you could take with a little bit of a grain of salt. I don't think anything about what we've seen thus far has indicated that Cleveland is soft. I don't think that that's fair. I think, you know, if you're going to win a championship, if you're going to go to a finals, you're going to have moments of adversity. And I know, you know, Cleveland faced some at the end of the regular season, but there wasn't great stakes at those moments. This is their first real, you know, crisis moment of what has been a charm season. How do they handle it? You know, and, you know, for 47 minutes of game two, I thought they handled it extraordinarily well. And then they obviously had a historically awful final 57 seconds. We'll see how they respond tomorrow night, but I still think they have an excellent chance to win the series.
What did they do wrong in game one?
In game one, what did they do wrong?
Yeah, because game two, it's like, all right, they were up by a bunch, then they lost the game. We went over it like crazy, but I'm like, man, game one, like, how do you lose game one? I can understand game two because everybody was injured.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, well, first of all, I do think just this in general – I think that people have underrated Indiana, you know, and I don't know if there was any of that from the Cavaliers mentally going into that game of not fully appreciating. You know, Indiana has been one of the best teams in the NBA since January 1st. And for all the talk about their struggles on the defensive end, they have not struggled on the defensive end since January 1st. And one thing we have seen from them is their ability to close out games, right? And to come back in games and to have a level of toughness and fortitude in those moments. You know, I thought in game one, it was pretty clear, you know, that they did not want to get Indiana into a bunch of those catch and shoot looks from three, and they were comfortable just switching everything, trying to avoid it. The problem was, especially Tyrese Halliburton really took advantage of those isolation opportunities. I mean, Jared Allen, who you normally feel pretty comfortable with switching on to anybody, Tyrese Halliburton scored more on him in isolation than he has any player this season in that first game. And so I thought there was just some opportunities created by defensive choices from Cleveland that Indiana was able to take advantage of. And then they also shot the lights out from three, and Cleveland missed their threes, right? Donovan Mitchell goes 1 of 11. Max Strus goes 2 of 8. Cleveland goes 9 for 38, and Indiana goes 19 for 36. Rarely is there a game in the NBA nowadays where you're going to win a game where one team shoots that much better from three.
Ryan Rucco, join us on the hotline. He'll have the call tomorrow night in Indy. By the way, how annoying is the revving of the Indy car sound that they play perpetually throughout the game?
I didn't know they did that.
You know what? I think at this point I'm immune to all extraneous arena noise, so it won't get under my skin like it otherwise would.
Do you have reverence for Red Panda the way that we do, or are you just too busy getting ready for the second half?
You know, I have reverence for Red Panda. I have ultimate respect for Red Panda. I don't do a good enough job of enjoying Red Panda.
Yeah, because
you know, to your point, it's not just getting ready for the second half, it's going to the bathroom as well. You know, like I don't want to go to the bathroom during Red Panda, but if I don't go to the bathroom at halftime, when can I go to the bathroom, guys? You know,
can't.
So I can't. So unfortunately, I only catch snippets of Red Panda's glory.
Ryan, we had a guy here who once, he told the story on the air. He actually used the bathroom and he was calling baseball and he was in the press box bathroom and he actually had the microphone on the radio, was looking out the door as he was doing the game. I don't think you can try to do the same thing, but who knows? I mean, maybe one day.
You know, you never know what's going to happen when you combine a lot of water and on-court entertainment with a microphone.
That's true.
Ryan, I heard Red Panda does not get out of bed for less than 50K.
That's not true.
And I heard her servant boys that catch the plates for her or start the entire process, they don't get out of bed for less than a grand.
No, it's okay.
Well, good. They should. I mean, supply and demand. There's only, you know, one Red Panda. She's a big halftime act. I hope that's what she's getting per pop.
Have you heard anything, Ryan, about the status of Evan Mobley? And if we do get him back, what type of Evan Mobley are we going to get?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything yet. I'm sure we're going to hear more as the day goes on. You know, what I think you'll get is, you know, what you've had. And I know in the first game, you know, the on-court numbers, you know, were not good with Mobley and Allen against Indiana. But this year, obviously, what was historically a problem was not the same problem this year, right? And Evan Mobley showed a level, and we saw it in certain games in the first round, too. He performed with a level of aggression and conviction, especially on the offensive end, that we had not seen before. He also was intentionally empowered by his teammates in a way that he had not been previously. And so I think it's obviously very significant getting him back, in addition to him being the defensive player of the year. I also think if I was a Cavs fan, that would be kind of what I would be hanging my hat on right now, to just try and, if I was trying to mentally turn this, right? Because the reality is, rarely in a close series does the team who loses a game the way the Cavs lost game two go on to win the series, right? Like, if you just look at different NBA playoff series throughout NBA history, usually the team who blows a game the way the Cavs did in game two does not go on to win the series when it is an evenly matched series or a closely matched series, which I think, obviously, this one is certainly more closely matched than most people were anticipating. However, what I would hang my hat on if I was a Cavs fan is they really do have a much different looking team that could be available to them in the rest of the series, depending on the status of Mobley, Hunter, and Garland. You know, if you're not going to get those three guys back, you're not going to come back from this 2-0 hole. Let me be very clear. It's not going to happen. You might win a game, you might win two. You're not winning four of the next five if you do not get those three guys back. If you get two of the three, maybe you have that possibility, but I do think, unfortunately, the injury status of those guys really is as big a factor in this series as you would fear it would be.
All right, Ryan, this show does not like to play the victim. We've always really thought of ourselves as a pull ourselves up by the bootstrap type of a show. With that said, 2-Minute Report came out yesterday and basically said the Cavs should have won the game. How much of a controversy is that to you? Are people talking about lane violations around the league? Will it even make the broadcast coming up on Friday night?
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll definitely mention the lane violations, because I think, you know, if you're going to look at what was the play that, you know, the momentum play that really sparked that rally at the end of the game, it was the Neesmith putback, right? So, which should have never happened. And quite frankly, as it happened, I said, well, that's a lane violation, you know. And I know they were, you know, they were talking about whether or not it was offensive interference. But one thing that needed to be mentioned is you can review in that moment for offensive interference, but you cannot then change it to a lane violation, you know. And so, unfortunately, even as the officials were looking at the monitor there to see if it was a goaltend, which it wasn't, they weren't able to adjudicate anything on the legality of it being a lane violation. And it was. And I thought it pretty clearly was when it happened. The Halliburton one, not as much, and I know that was as well. But the Neesmith one I thought was an obvious lane violation. And it's a huge missed call. You know, we can't act like it wasn't – it didn't play a role in the end of the game. Of course it played a role in the end of the game. Having said that, you still had a very comfortable lead, so to speak, late in that game. That is not the only thing that went wrong, right? You know, that didn't force Cleveland to not be able to inbound the ball at all, you know, in those final moments, to have to burn timeouts in those final moments because of their inbounding struggles. You know, it didn't have anything to do with Donovan Mitchell's offensive foul or some of the turnovers earlier in the quarter that helped spark Indiana even getting to within striking distance. I know it felt like it was finally over when Strus hit that three to go up by seven, but the reality is, you know, the game felt like it was over a quarter and a half before that, and Cleveland made a lot of mistakes early in that fourth quarter to allow Indiana within that 7, 8, 9 point striking distance. So I think you can definitely be upset about those missed calls. They were incorrect. They played a role. There's no way around that. But you also have to be real about what happened and where the momentum was at that moment in the game because of the plethora of mistakes that happened going into it. And we heard Kenny Atkinson say his one regret was not playing more guys because he felt like they ran out of gas. And I do think there's a philosophical conversation here, and I don't think there's a right or a wrong, guys, at least that I feel conviction in, but there's a philosophical conversation here when you see what a team like the Knicks has done even at the end of these games against the Celtics, right, versus a team whose players have played basically 30 minutes a game all year and then all of a sudden are being asked to play 45. Like, can you still perform? Are you built up for that? And that's a real debate within – different performance teams throughout this league is what is better for you to be able to perform in those playoff moments when the minutes go up? Is it having more reps in the regular season where your minutes are higher, but then you're risking being burned out in a regular season? Or is it, you know, getting rest, but then maybe you don't have that reservoir of energy to go to in those moments when you do need them? And so I think, you know, depending on how the rest of this series plays out, that might be a question that Cleveland's asking itself at the end of this year, because in that game, clearly they ran out of gas. There were mitigating circumstances. They had three essential players hurt, and that obviously dramatically changes the rotation. But I also think that's an interesting little, you know, kind of macro picture to dive into, depending on how the rest of these playoffs play out.
Ryan, you've also been the voice of the Women's National Championship in basketball, the WNBA. Is Caitlin Clark one of the top three most famous basketball players you've ever covered?
Oh, no question. No, well, I've ever covered? Yeah, I think she still is. Today, there is no doubt today that the three most famous basketball players currently playing are LeBron, Steph, and Caitlin. There's no question. You know, in my life, you know, I did get to do some Kobe games. So, you know, Kobe would be obviously in there as well. Probably some others that I'm not thinking of. But, yeah, her fame is crazy, guys. I was in Iowa doing that game last week, and the atmosphere in Iowa was ridiculous for her return for that preseason game. There were fans tailgating 4 hours before the game started. The game sold out in less than 25 minutes. The average ticket price then was $670 by game time.
Preseason game?
Wow.
For a preseason game.
Wow.
See, it is almost impossible to contextualize her metric impact when it comes to team sports, because really the only thing that I think is a fair comp when it comes to her outsized impact on ratings and all, you know, aspects of commerce is Tiger Woods. I really think that's when you look at Tiger Woods and his effect on golf, I think that's the equivalent of Caitlin Clark's effect on women's basketball. And even just, you know, the other game, like this preseason game, it's unbelievable how many people in my life are reaching out to me afterwards. Oh my gosh, that 36 footer she hit. She plays a completely different way than anybody we have ever seen in the history of the women's game. And it's a very exciting, electrifying style.
We thank you very much, Ryan. I totally agree with you. I think that's the perfect example. Perfect example, yeah, with Caitlin Clark and Tiger Woods. We hope you have a great call Have a great playoffs. We'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, I just want to give Cleveland fans one little bit of hope, okay? You win. If you win tomorrow, you get a good night of sleep, right? Like, all it takes is one win to change the way you feel. That's the crazy thing about the playoffs. It can feel over one night, and it can feel totally rejuvenated the next. So that's, you know, that's how quick it can turn.
I'll be passing out either way. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys. See ya.
Ryan Rucco, ESPN, joining us on the North Homestead Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Excellent stuff from him. I love the comparison to Tiger Woods. I think it's absolutely true, especially when you're talking about the WNBA getting new teams.
I'm doing well, guys. How are you?
Good. Well, you painted the picture for me.
Sam is Hoopswire, by the way.
He is.
He doesn't just write for it. He is Hoopswire.
Do you want to be Hoopswire, or do you want to be someone who writes for Hoopwire?
Well, it's his website.
I could be both.
He's the man.
He wants to be both, and that's what's important. That's why we have him on the show. All right. Well, thanks for painting that great picture for me, my friend. Five times at home, an NBA team. Lost the first two at home, and then still won the series. So you're saying there's a chance.
Well, you have to believe, right? You don't really have a choice at this point if you're the Cleveland Cavaliers and now Boston Celtics, both down 2-0, which we haven't seen this before. This is NBA history, the wrong side of it, but we've never seen two teams. We've never seen one 60-win team down 2-0 in the second round, and now we have two. In the same span of a week. So, you know, yeah, there's stats that show that they could do it. You know, if you're the Cavs, that's what you got to hang your hat on. It's been done.
So we should blame the commissioner. Is that what we're saying?
Might as well.
Sounds good.
I think he gets blamed for everything else. So I'm on board.
He does get blamed for everything else, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. All commissioners do.
Come with the job, part of the job, right?
part of the making a lot of money. So I get that completely. How injured are the Cavs? And do you think that there's any chance that these guys play?
I go back and forth. You know, I think that clearly the injuries are pretty severe. Not to be Debbie Downer, but you're talking about a sprained toe, which is, you know, I've seen people say he needs to come out and play, and there's probably some validity to that. But I don't think that Darius Garland, not to use a double negative in the same sentence, but I don't think he doesn't want to play. He wants to play, you know, and he's gone out there a few times and done some workouts, and it's been decided that he wouldn't be able to contribute. You know, based on the injury. Evan Mobley was limping noticeably after game two. And DeAndre Hunter, a dislocated thumb on your shooting hand. You got to go with what the coach has said, and Kenny Atkinson has said that they are all, you know, day-to-day status is up in the air. I can tell you this. With as angry as Kenny Atkinson is about it being physical, and you know, we heard his very fair comments on perhaps the line of physicality being crossed and him being agitated with that, it makes me think that it's not great news because we don't see Kenny Atkinson very sour, or at least this sour, very often.
Let me ask you something about the way the game is played right now. You see Boston blow two 20-point leads in back-to-back games. You see the Cavaliers blow a 20-point lead, even though a great effort to get that with all of the injuries. I wonder, the Celtics and the Cavs, two of the top four teams in the NBA in three-pointers attempted per game. Is there any correlation there? That's in the regular season. They were two of the top.
Right.
Celtics were number one. Cavs were number four.
There could be. You know, look, I mean, the old saying, old school saying, is live by the three, die by the three.
Right.
Right? Now, Golden State, for years turned that on its ear, which was, well, we're not dying by the three. But people forget about those Warrior Dynasty teams. They got so many shots at the rim by cutting and you know, almost running kind of the old school Princeton offense,
yeah,
where it's constant motion, and they just happen to have, you know, the best 3-point shooter in this era, and really actually two of them, and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. So, you know, a lot of teams have mimicked that. Kenny Atkinson and other coaches will call the Celtics run the five out, where all five guys are kind of shooting threes, your center, everybody. So we've seen Boston take and miss a record number of threes. And I think maybe partially, guys, when we're watching these playoffs, they let you be so much more physical defensively around the perimeter. We've seen how the Pacers and other teams will kind of push, grab, claw, and you never know what the refs are going to let them get away with in the playoffs. So, yeah, I think that you need to be, all of a sudden, with the kind of rules changing in the playoffs, that can impact teams that have had success doing it a certain way in the regular season.
Is it good or bad? We had a caller that brought up a great point. It's like, okay, if you're going to decide to let teams play, well, why wouldn't you just do that during the regular season too? Like, again, we're all just looking for consistency, right? That's it. We're just looking for consistency. And if you've got one ref that's going to let him play and one who isn't, it's bothersome to sit here and even have to talk about the refs. And I wonder if we would be if the Cavs were up 2-0. That's the other thing, too. If we were on the other side of this, would we be talking about the refs?
Well, no. Nobody would be. But I can tell you this, and that's a great point that the caller made.
Mm-hmm.
Because I sat there last night watching the Celtics game, and I thought, you know, you're totally changing the style of play in the playoffs. You let them play one way all year, which is freedom of movement, right? That's
right.
The NBA's big rally cry. Freedom of movement, not really allowed or supposed to close out on shooters during the regular season. You get called for flagrant if you get too close to a shooter, if your foot lands underneath him. You know, so closing out on shooters is discouraged during the regular season. During the playoffs, it's anything goes. And I'm just like, you know, forget the Cavs being down 2-0. I just look at the product overall, and I'm like, why all of a sudden have you changed the rules? Are you not as big on freedom of movement? Are you allowing dangerous closeouts on shooters? You know, I think the reason the Cavs are down 2-0 is because they haven't had their all-star point guard. I don't think it's the officiating. I think it's they're struggling to get the ball up the floor a lot of times. And, you know, Darius Garland clearly would change all that because he gets to wherever he wants to go on the court.
How good is Indiana?
Indiana is basically the same team as the Cavs, right? They're just a little more physical. But they're basically, when I watched the Pacers, I saw them a few times against the Bucks, and I thought, boy, people who are writing this off as an easy series for the Cavs are going to be way off, because this team very much mirrors the Cavaliers in the style that they play. They have, even though they called him overrated and he wasn't an all-star this year, they have an all-star caliber point guard in Tyrese Halliburton. They have a very good power forward who was an all-star in Pascal Siakam and Miles Turner. They're very deep. Those guys can shoot threes. You know, and Rick Carlisle said that the other day. He said it before the game. He said, I feel that these two teams mirror each other in our style of play and our efficiency. Since January 1st, guys, the Pacers have been, what, the third best record in the NBA? Now maybe second best record in the NBA if you include the playoffs.
How do the Cavs change this around? Forget about trying to win four games at once. They got to win one game, game three, and then they can worry about game four. So what do they need to do to win, and can they be a more physical team?
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know that they have to be more physical because they were up 20, what, twice game two. So you just need one. I mean, look, this isn't to blame anybody because it's a team-wide thing, but Ty Jerome, right, 1 of 14. He goes 3 of 14 in game two. That's over. That game is over. Couple more made threes from somebody else, game over. So they just have to do and defend like they did for 46 of the 48 minutes. You know, you can't have these small, Jared Allen said it the other night, you can't have these small mental lapses if you don't have your guys. But frankly, I think the only way they're going to get out of this series, and I still think there's a chance, but I think you need at least one of your injured guys back, and I think it either needs to be Mobley or Darius Garland. You're not going to win the series without at least one of those two.
Who else do you like in the NBA playoffs? Can the Knicks finish this off against the Celtics? Denver had a great win in game one, but then just got smoked last night. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the Nuggets for you. I mean, they did that against the Clippers too, right? They had a great win, and then they get crushed, and then they come back and win the series. I still, you know, what's funny, I sat there thinking last night, yeah, I still don't think the Knicks are going to win that series. I still don't believe.
I feel the same thing. I don't know why I feel that way.
Probably because it's the defending champ and all that. And at least I do. I sit there and have strong doubts about the Cavs. The difference is, of course, the Cavs have three key players injured. The Celtics do not. But, you know, New York is the Knicks are always the Knicks. And they could very well just go right back home and lose both. So, you know, to me, I thought Golden State was cooking again. But now with Steph Curry being out a week, I really think far and away right now, far and away, the top two teams that I've seen are number one, the Oklahoma City Thunder when they're clicking, and number two, the Indiana Pacers. That to me, those have been the top two teams of the second round, Eddie.
Sammy, as always, thank you. We're always reading on Hoopswire to see what the latest is, and good stuff, my friend, good stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, guys, thanks for having me. We'll talk to you later.
To go ahead and talk about this series, to talk about, well, all the other series going on as well. We head out to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. You know him from NBA.com, NBA writer and analyst Steve Ashburner joining us now. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. Was the Cavs loss last night to Indiana, was that more of a collapse by them or a comeback by Indiana?
Well, seeing that the Pacers have done this now in each of the two rounds, they did it against Milwaukee. As improbable as it is, I'm going to give them the credit. You know, I think we need to, you know, refer to them as the cardiac Carlisles or something like that.
Because we won't do that in this city, Steve.
Oh, okay, all right. Anyway, no, it was uncanny that what they did to the Bucks, they came out and they did it again to be. You know, like Michael Myers, and you think he's dead. You think they're gone. Nope. They're still in it, and they're gonna snag that game. So you know, of course, you factor in the front end of it was no Mobley, no Garland, who am I
Hunter.
Blanking on? Yeah, Hunter. I mean, that's a tough way to go into any playoff situation. So no, give Indiana its due. Now that said, the Cavaliers. They need to get busy. I picked them to win this series in six games. So I'm not wrong yet, but it's going to take some doing.
So do you still believe they can win this series down 2-0?
Well, you tell me which of those injured guys is going to be back. And if you tell me all three of them, then I definitely think so. But if this is a situation that lingers, I think they need at least two of them back to be able to dig out of this hole.
Steve Ashburner on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Where does the burden fall if, let's say, you get Evan and Hunter back, but maybe you don't get Darius back?
Well, it's kind of the way they navigated the first round then, right? I mean, it's they've sort of, I feel like they've kind of adjusted to not having Garland. As helpful, as valuable as he is, that's more of a known quantity. They've had time, even in between series, to practice or you know, game plan without him on board. But I don't think you can lose Mobley, period. And even Hunter as a recent DNP, that's, you know, that's a little bit trickier. That's a curveball headed your way. So I don't think that they're in dire straits if it's only, and I put only in air quotes, Darius Garland who's out, because, you know, they're a little more familiar with that.
How much should Donovan feel like he's got to put the world on his shoulders? You know, in Utah, he did this a lot, but he hasn't had to do it. And he took a step back this year in being the guy that just does everything. But in the first two games of the series, he's taken 30 shots in each, and he feels like he really does have to.
I think he does have to. I think particularly when you're missing three guys like that, I think that the whole dynamic of that team shifts. I mean, we give him a lot of credit for the way he shared the ball, fit himself to the talents of his teammates, didn't need to be, you know, the alpha dog all the time, and basically downshifted. And you know, unfortunately, it's not fair, but you know, when those other guys are not available, or even in games where they're not, you know, they're not humming, you know, it's sort of on him then, again, as the leader, to take over to a large degree. I think that, you know, he knows what that is to do that. So you're not asking anything of him that is foreign to him or premature in his learning curve or anything like that. He's done it before. Yeah, it's not their preferred style of play. It's not what he's been used to doing. He's probably just as tired as you know, those years where he had to do it with Utah at this stage. But, I do think it requires a little bit more hero ball, and I'd hate to see him taking fewer shots.
Steve, when the Cavs lost last night, there were some Cavs fans that maybe turned their attention to Evan Mobley, DeAndre Hunter, and Darius Garland, and questioning whether they should have played last night. Is it fair to criticize any one of those three guys, or any, like, all three of them together for missing last night?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. I mean, if this was a regular season game and you had any suspicions that it was load management, but we're just going to pace ourselves because we have a nice lead in the Eastern Conference, you know, then I think you get impatient. If you're dropping $200-$300 on tickets, you know, then I think, you know, I'm sympathetic to the fans on that sort of stuff. But I don't think these guys, particularly where they're at in their careers, you know, they're not babying themselves. They're not jaking it. They're not doing anything negative. If they could play, I think they would, and I think that, you know, the same thing with the coaches and management. I don't think that they would, you know, fall on a grenade for these guys and say, no, you know, we'll risk losing another home game and just to save you some wear and tear. I think that this is as valid a proof as anything that these injuries are legit.
How do you explain in the fourth quarter the Cavs just looking and feeling so gassed and so tired? Because, you know, they had not been playing as many minutes. Donovan played fewer minutes than he's ever played. Is it anything to do with that, or is it just playoff basketball and the intensity?
Well, and their rotation is out of whack. I mean, the times where guys are used to getting a blow, they're not, because, you know, Mobley's not soaking up a bunch of minutes. Garland's not there. Hunter's not coming in. I mean, sixth man of the year candidate. You have guys thrust into the starting lineup. So the whole rotation is out of whack. I think that's I just think literally the way the minutes are allotted to you, you know, it's challenging. And I think also there's some mental wear and tear when, you know that you have a very, a much thinner margin of error than you do on a given night. Cleveland's one of the deepest teams in the league with with Boston, with Indiana, with OKC, and all of a sudden now you're going to go down three. And I just, you know, I saw I'm in Minnesota, so I had to work the late game, and I couldn't watch all of this, the Cleveland Indiana game, but I was surprised, but encouraged when they had the big lead. And then when I saw things sort of get a little closer, then it was like, yeah, okay, well, that does not surprise me because of, like I say, the manpower situation. I mean, nobody expects a 7-point lead to evaporate in less than a minute the way it did. But I think the tremors that went through all the Cleveland fans when they learned that those three guys were not going to be around for game two, I mean, those were legit. And the being able to lead that game was almost a bonus. They could have gotten blown out.
Steve, if the Cavs end up losing this series, let's make it competitive. Let's say go six or seven games. If the Cavs lose this series, is this season a failure for the Cavs?
Let's get Giannis to answer that failure question, right?
He could palm my head like a basketball. Absolutely, yeah, not.
A few years ago, he quibbled with that notion. I wouldn't say it's a failure. I it's a disappointment. That's the reason Kenny Atkinson won Coach of the Year, was that he took a very good team and dialed it up to an elite level. And so you don't expect an elite team, the number one seed in the conference, to go out in the second round. Now, if these injuries don't alleviate, then, that takes some of the sting out of it, I would guess. Not for people who are looking forward to seeing the Cavaliers play, deep into May, but it's understandable. But I wouldn't say a failure, but no, it is a disappointment. And I hope, I'm sure they won't try to imitate the Phoenix Suns and fire yet another coach. I think this was the next logical step. They needed to get to a conference finals. Each of these guys was working on his game. I thought Mobley, he's improved, and Garland had improved, and Mitchell's still, a top scorer. And it's ending too soon if this is indeed, as far as they get.
Yeah, and I think with injuries not being a factor here, I think there's not many people that would make the case that the Pacers are a better team than the Cavs. But the Pacers have certainly impressed people, even with the injuries that the Cavs have had and getting over them in that game two, and especially in game one as well. What did we underrate about Indiana, where now maybe it seems like they are one of the better teams in the East?
Well, can we say Tyrese Haliburton? I guess it was just a handful. 13 players was enough to win him the overrated label in that poll by the that national sports website that anonymously polled NBA players. And we've seen in this postseason already how much that poll actually was worth, right? I mean, overrated? No, I don't think so at all. I think there might be jealousy. If you're anonymously assessing guys you don't like, you might, stick an overrated thing on somebody because you sort of resent the attention he gets or how he's treated in Indiana or whatever it is. I think, because of that, you could almost say that Haliburton was underrated if you're going to go around calling him overrated. I think the Pacers, they have great depth. They have great continuity. They were in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. I know some people thought that was a fluke. Milwaukee wasn't healthy, and they were picked, in the first round to defeat Indiana, and yet there went the Pacers. They kept climbing. So I think probably Carlisle's a little underrated for being able to, do for his team what it needs. And, I like their role players. I think they really have guys who know they're stars in their roles. That's the new NBA cliche, but it's true. T.J. McConnell off the bench. Aaron Nesmith, who used to be with Boston and was kind of a discard. And, I want him on my team. I mean, I think he's a tremendous 3-and-D type of guy, great energy. You saw in that, that tip dunk off the missed free throw. I think they have a great camaraderie. And, they come at you. I mean, they are not afraid of you know, putting up shots early in the shot clock and keeping you off pace. If you want to walk that ball and play half court, you know, you better do it really well, because Indiana's going to be, you know, they're going to be running on your makes.
All right, Steve, we got about 30 seconds here. You're watching this Minnesota series up close here. Golden State wins game one but loses Steph Curry for at least a week. Do you think that's enough to swing this fully in the favor of the Timberwolves from here on out?
It ought to be, right? The other team loses its best player for at least three more games, and you're only one game into the series. Minnesota should win those three so that when Curry comes back, you know, it's at least a fairly daunting challenge for the Warriors to overcome it. All Golden State has to do is win one of these three games coming up over the next week. And if Curry is available, then it's a best of three series with Steph Curry back. So, Minnesota, you know, they're still missing a little chip of maturity. They have lost games during the season. They lost to Indiana when it didn't have Haliburton. They lost to Milwaukee when it didn't have Giannis or Lillard. You know, if they let their human nature get the better of them and they relax at all, thinking, oh, we don't have to worry about Steph, they'll be the ones, being left behind.
Steve, great stuff, buddy. Appreciate you, and enjoy the rest of that series. And I'm sure we'll have you on down the line to talk more Cavaliers basketball.
Very good. You're welcome.
Steve Ashburner there, NBA.com and the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. We'll react to what he had to say about the Cavs. Sure sounds like he thinks the series is over. That's in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.